From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. The Bougainville and Papua New Guinea governments will meet in 2 weeks to make key decisions preparing for next year's referendum. Bougainville is set to vote on possible independence as the final step of the 2001 peace agreement, which formally ended a 10-year-long civil war. PNG Prime Minister Peter O'Neill and Bougainville President John Momes met in Port Moresby on Monday and have agreed to hold a special meeting of the Joint Supervisory Board, the JSB, in 2 weeks' time. The JSB is to establish the question for the referendum and set up a commission to prepare for the event. Mr. Momes told Don Wiseman he understands the many pressures the national government faces and how this has delayed earlier JSB meetings.
The national government has been caught up in many important matters and events, one of which is the preparations for the APEC meeting, which will take place in November. And of course, prior to that, APEC officials from the different countries have been attending conferences and seminars and meetings in Port Moresby. So that took up a lot of time for the government, unfortunately. And so it's important matters for the preparations for the referendum were sort of delayed. But I'm happy to say that I met with the Prime Minister and we agreed that the next JSB meeting, which will be a special JSB meeting, will be held in 2 weeks' time, to which we will be inviting the independent chair, Mr. Bertie Ahern, to attend. And preparations will be carried out immediately, put in place forthwith to get, you know, the stage ready for this important meeting.
What sort of impression did you get from Mr. O'Neill about his attitude toward this referendum? Because he's been somewhat ambivalent, hasn't he, in the past?
The Prime Minister is committed. He said to me that the referendum will be held and will be held in good time and before the end of next year, because if we leave it too late, you're running the risk of running into the ABD elections in 2020. The Prime Minister was upbeat. He was very positive and assured me we will move to mountains to make sure the referendum is held in good time.
Back in August, Mr. O'Neill had said that one of the key things holding things up was this inability to reach a decision or to agree on just what the question or questions would be in the referendum. So is that now solved? Have you sorted that out?
Yes, the matter of determining the question or questions to be put has taken a long time, and we now believe that we are ready to determine which question or questions will be put to the next JSB meeting. I feel strongly that both the Prime Minister and I agree that there should only be one question to avoid any possibility of creating confusion, of risking quality outcome of the referendum. So I'm happy again to say that we are making good progress and that particular question or issue will be determined in the next special JSB meeting.
Earlier this year, there had been talk about how there were very tight timelines if this referendum was to happen in June of next year. So we're now in October. Is it going to be possible to have everything sorted in time for June of next year?
The schedule will be tight. We grant that will be the case, most probably the case, but we are determined that necessary steps will be taken to ensure that the referendum, whether it's held dead on the indicative date of June, 15th of June next year, or a little bit later, it will happen. A referendum must be conducted to determine the position or the view of the people of Bougainville, and then the process of consultation, so on and so forth, will take place thereafter.
The Cook Islands Court of Appeal has upheld the claim by the chief's body, Agronomana of Tatu Alotonga, an environmental group, Te Impaka Society, imposing the government's purse-seine fishing boats. Both groups have challenged the government's partnership agreement with the European Union, which allows EU purse centers to fish in Cook Island waters. They have changed last year's High Court ruling in favor of the government. Kevin Passfield from the Society told Don Wiseman what prompted the court action.
both parties had different reasons, and our reason was that we thought that the agreement with the EU for adding even more effort into the purse seine fishery just was not a decision which was made based on promoting a sustainable fishery. We thought there were issues with the fishery that needed to be addressed, and they weren't addressed in the details of the fishing agreement.
So the Court of Appeal has upheld the claim that there needed to have been an environmental impact assessment done. Just tell us why your organisation saw this as so important.
Well, it's one of the things we do, you know, as an environmental non-government organisation for the Cook Islands. We are concerned with things that are going to impact negatively on the environment. And we saw this as being a significant impact on some of the marine resources which would be harvested under the fisheries agreement. So it was just that we see it as a part of our job, basically. We comment on all sorts of environmental impact assessments that are done for tourism developments and land clearing on slopes, etc. And this was just another example, albeit a much more significant one, perhaps, for the country.
Why do you think the government went into all of this without doing these things?
Personally, I think the key individual who was making the agreements, I think, was just, to be honest, a little bit arrogant in his assumption that he could do this without having a more fuller consultation with people who would be impacted, i.e. the people of the Cook Islands.
So what happens now?
Well, the government's been told that they have to conduct an EIA. They've been given 12 months to do that. So I understand there might be a new head of the Ministry of Marine Resources. So it will be up to that person to follow through with the instructions of the court. And the government's also been instructed they'll have to review the fishery plan, because under the fishery plan, it has to be reviewed every 2 years. And it hasn't been reviewed since it was made in 2013. So they're two of the things that will have to be done. The court didn't rule that they would set aside the agreement, as in, you know, call the agreement with the EU null and void, which, you know, it's understandable, the financial implications of doing that now, and also the potential political fallout of perhaps getting the EU offside for the Cook Islands government would not be a nice thing to happen. So we understand the reasons why the court has not set that agreement aside, but they're saying that now an EIA has to be done, and then hopefully some changes would be made to that agreement to make it more sustainable.
In the meantime, are there boats from the EU in Cook Islands waters?
Yeah, I understand there's two of the purse seiners from the EU are fishing in the waters. Whether they are there at this very moment, I'm not sure. But they are licensed to fish in the waters for the year, and they've got approval for two other boats. But I understand only two of the four boats have actually fished so far.
A newly released comprehensive climate report warns that rapid, far-reaching, unprecedented changes are needed in all aspects of society to limit global warming. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, says limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to 2 degrees Celsius is necessary to ensure more sustainable and equitable societies. Associate Professor Brunyard Hayward from the University of Canterbury is one of the report's authors. She told Jenny Meyer about her collaboration with Pacific climate researchers and how the region is sending a clear message to the rest of the world on the impact of global climate change.
It was an honour and a privilege to work with Pacific writing teams and to work with some really terrific PhD students from Kiribati and also from the University of the South Pacific and from Vanuatu. And one of the feature studies that is going to be within this report is a feature about how communities can live resiliently in a changing climate. And when we looked at the world's literature on actually how to do it, Vanuatu emerged as one of the kind of success stories in terms of communities that are thinking very carefully about how we need to make change at all levels, how to bring people with us in this really difficult time, how to protect the community, and what kinds of long-term and short-term changes we need to make. So Vanuatu is featured as one of the kinds of exemplars, really, for other countries to follow.
People in the Pacific are living with the impact of climate change every day. Mm. This report does call for rapid and far-reaching intervention to try and turn things around and limit the degree of global warming. So there seems to be quite a big split between those who it's an everyday reality and those who it's still perhaps theory. What are your thoughts about that?
I think in many ways this report is also going to be a shock for people who think that climate change is something that happens in the future. So for those who haven't been confronted with it every day, as most of the Pacific is, the report is very stark. Climate change is happening now, and we need to make changes now. It's not some mythical future anymore. The changes are now that we need to make, and they need to be deep and far-reaching, and they have to affect all aspects of life. Now, for most of the Pacific, this is an everyday reality. But for many countries who feel more distant from this, it will be a shock. And it will be a shock for them to realise the extent to which perhaps 10 million people are going to be affected just by sea level rise alone if we can't hold the world's climate at 1.5. Perhaps another 420 million will be affected by heat stress. These are realities for the Pacific. This will be a shock for the rest of the world because it's the end of magical thinking that we can somehow put this off. So I hope it's a wake-up call, but it is always so difficult.
One of the things that was recently discussed at the Nauru Pacific Islands Forum was the idea of climate change and security. And it does seem that as climate stress really impacts on the Pacific nations more and more, there's a possibility of unrest and a kind of a destabilizing effect in the region. What do you think can be done to try and help with those more social issues? Are they addressed in the report, for example?
Yes, this report is the first time that climate change has been put in a social context of how do we actually sustain development and support poverty and support human well-being, Indigenous rights and human security. So rather than putting climate change over on the side, it's back into everyday life. And I think how we make what we're calling climate resilient development actually real, because it's already being experienced now, it's the Pacific that's been leading this, which is why Vanuatu is one of the case studies that's featured in this report. But I think Steve Rituva here at Pacific Macmillan Brown has been very conscious of the way in which security and climate change are going increasingly hand in hand. And certainly this report, at least in briefly, it talks about the need to achieve sustainable development goals of peace and human security have to be facilitated by also affecting climate change. So for the first time, we've tried to bring social objectives alongside climate in a world report and actually force this onto the public agenda. And I think that in itself becomes a very significant debate. How leaders choose to respond to it, well, the IPCC can only underscore the writing and the work that's being done. They can't tell them what to do. But I hope that it supports the dialogues that are going on at the moment and the decision-making that happens in Poland, because certainly the report is very clear that the rest of the world is not making enough contributions to limit climate at the moment to 1.5.
That's a big conference coming up, isn't it, at the end of the year in Poland, and I think it sort of is like an extension of where to from here from the Paris Agreement. One of the things that, you know, we've seen with perhaps the politics, like you say, is that scientists perhaps are really struggling more than ever to get across the importance and the relevance of science and of facts, you know, in an age of alternative facts. How do you think that can be turned around so that people really take this information seriously?
I think one of the things that is going to really shock people who haven't lived in the Pacific and aren't experiencing this every day is when they experience a flood or people they know are experiencing major storm events. And in many ways, it's that personal life experience of extreme weather events that actually starts to really jolt people and you realise, gosh, climate change isn't in the future, it's now. But the difficulty with that is that when people get scared, they make rushed decisions that are not always in everybody's best interests. So one of the big pushes in this report is for governments to lead careful planning that takes the whole community with them. And that requires all the things that the Pacific has been arguing for a very long time, gender development and support for women and new voices to be heard in decision-making, adequate finance to support different options, and other countries to step up to their responsibilities. I think if New Zealand can take a lead to bringing other countries into this conversation that's happening in the Pacific, and the Pacific itself is taking a lead in a lot of the international negotiations now. That is starting to change a conversation, but it is very hard.
What's your overall impression of the report? Is it a hopeless case, or do you think there's still a chance, is there still a window of opportunity to actually really stop the current situation in its tracks and turn the momentum around?
That's such a good question, Jenny. And I think a key message that's coming out that's maybe not at the front enough is that if we have about two-thirds of a chance, which is better than no chance, two-thirds of a chance to hold the world's temperatures at 1.5, we have to make these big, deep cuts in every aspect of our lives in the next 10 years. So it's starting now and for the next 10 years. We have to have made really, really significant cuts. Now, whether we can achieve that, scientists aren't gods, and I personally get a bit frustrated when everyone says, no, it's not possible, because where you have a will, you have a way, and in the Pacific, there is no option. We actually do have to take action. We actually have to do it now, and there are some really significant things we could do around key areas, around our oil production and around use of fossil fuels, around transport, around farming practices, all of which would make a significant difference. But it's also everybody's little bits of activities, not within the Pacific, which produces hardly any of the greenhouse gases, but within the rest of the world. So getting this message across to everybody else to say, actually, there are no other people that can make changes. We are the other people that need to make the changes. That's going to be the hardest part of getting this report to really sink home.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The unsuccessful candidate for a senior post at the World Health Organization says he probably will have a job if some Pacific countries hadn't been brought out. Colin Tukiatonga fell short of the votes needed to become the regional director of the WHO for the Western Pacific, losing out to Japan's candidate, Dr. Takeshi Kazai. Dr. Tukiatonga, who is presently the head of the Pacific community, says he went into the vote with near unanimous support of the Pacific countries, but fell short when it came to the actual vote. He told Jamie Tahana a few Melanesian countries changed their support at the last minute, with some admitting to him that their vote was bought.
A disappointing result for all of us, especially myself. There were a lot of people involved in this, but it was not to be. Unfortunately, a lot of promises offered but not kept, and it looks as if other influences came into play, and we did not get the support that we thought we had.
Other influences such as what?
Oh, I think it's no secret that some people use money to get influence. It's not the thing that New Zealand does, which I'm happy with, of course. In my view, it's a moral victory to us. But obviously, the Pacific constituency, in its broader sense, who nominated and suggested that I do this, didn't honour their commitments. That's the unfortunate thing.
So Japan was going around with a checkbook, is essentially what you're saying.
Well, most visibly, of course, that's what happened, even though there was supposedly a code of conduct that prevented these sort of things from happening. It's corrupt and it's unacceptable.
So in what cases did this happen, and which countries changed their support despite earlier pledges? Because you had unanimous at one stage.
It's a secret ballot, so it's hard to be certain. I do know that the Polynesian group remained intact and were consistent, including Nauru. Beyond that, it's hard to say. Some of the Melanesian countries, of course, had publicly stated what they were going to do, and that's okay. But it was a bit hard to tell in the middle there who was voting for who.
And so how do you know that was because of the checkbook thing? Are there projects that have come? Have some come out to say that blatantly?
Well, I mean, I think we're all aware of the announcements that have been made in the public about a hospital here and an airport building there in the various places around the Pacific. Ministers and their officials told me directly what they have been offered. Upgrade to a better hotel, those sorts of things. You know, people are reluctant to talk about it, but these things happen.
You're saying if it was that fair battle, you probably would have the job right now?
Well, I mean, obviously I don't have it, but I'm saying that if you look at the numbers, the Pacific, had the group stuck together, it would have been a different outcome. And clearly there were influences that led to the result that we have.
By how many votes was your count off by?
There's a total of 30 votes. We got 12 in the first round and 12 in the second round. There were four candidates, and the two that dropped out, obviously the votes went to Japan, and I think they ended up with 16, which is what was needed. We got 12.
So how many did you think you had going into that?
Well, initially we had assessed on the basis of the promises made that it could have been as high as 18, but in the end it was not to be.
So what's that, six countries changing their votes, and they're Melanesian, are they?
Oh, but that, you know, as I said, it was a secret ballot, so it's hard to tell. The Melanesian nations did tell us what they were going to do, so I suppose it's no surprise, but it's a bit hard to tell in the middle there who was doing what.
During the campaign, you said voting for Japan is a vote for more of the same in the World Health Organization for the Western Pacific. So there's going to be no change this term then, is it?
Well, I suppose I was comparing, my campaign was based on change and to try to do things better. It's no secret that the health care systems and the health situation of Pacific people is not good, and it's been like that for many years, and I'm rather doubtful that the vote will change anything. The irony, of course, is that the health systems in the Melanesian countries are probably not the best that we have, and the vote, I mean, you know, obviously we have to accept that this is what the countries have decided to do, and I imagine that they have taken these into consideration. But I'm not hopeful that WHO will do anything terribly different.
Because in your Pacific community role, you would have done a lot of work with the WHO and got to know them and such. What are they like to work with in regards to these issues?
Yeah, we obviously have done some good things with WHO. I should concede that. The Pacific Roadmap on NCDs, for example, which we're using around the region, was developed with WHO, the World Bank. This is some good developments, but overall, these organizations have a long-term culture of work that doesn't necessarily address the concerns. And I'm particularly aware of the fact that the small island states, I do not believe, are getting their needs met. But that's just my view. And obviously, some of the ministers have decided that they appear to be happy with what's going on. But I think it's fair to say that we could do a lot better.
Niu won't raise the New Zealand flag or sing the national anthem during Constitutional Day celebrations later this month. In an unusual move, an MP says it has emerged that a tiff between the two countries. Niu will mark its 44th year of independence on October 19th, with New Zealand's High Commissioner expected to attend. Opposition MP Terry Coe says the decision not to raise the New Zealand flag and only the Niuean flag and sing the Niuean national anthem is politically diverse and comes amid concerns over Niu's auditing process. He told Mackenzie Smith it was first raised in Parliament last Wednesday.
And the Premier said that's right, and he's doing it because it's Niue's day, not New Zealand's day. So there was a discussion amongst all the members. Some disagreed and some agreed. But, you know, I said to him, it's why he's doing this is because of the tiff that he's got with New Zealand at the moment. It's not a good thing that we're, you know, breaking away from tradition, and also that we're, you know, New Zealand citizens. So why not raise the flag and sing the national anthem when the High Commissioner arrives, you know? So, and then after that, when the Premier arrives, we can raise the flag and sing our national anthem for Niue.
Tell me about this tiff with New Zealand.
Well, he said there was no tiff, but I believe that there is one, and he's not getting his own way with New Zealand, you know, with the aid funding and the projects, etc. They're wanting accountability and transparency in the money that New Zealand is giving to us. And
then, you know, this is not happening. And the proof of that is that the auditors from New Zealand cannot get the documents and that to sign off on the audits for the last 3 years. So, you know, the accountability in the state-owned enterprises, there's no documentation and no auditing of those accounts as yet because they're not clear and they're not available.
So there's a backlog of unaudited accounts in Niue right now, and that's you're saying that's affecting New Zealand's willingness to provide funding?
Not so much that way, but the Premier is criticising the audits and saying, you know, it's their fault and not our fault. But it's our fault, all right, because we haven't got the accounts ready for the auditors when they come up. It's quite plain. And we need more staff, you know, in the Treasury to make that happen. We've got an expat that's coming in every 2 or 3 months, but, you know, you need an expat here permanently so that we can make sure all these documents that the auditors want are available on time. You know, it's quite clear that there's the conflict in that area. And as I say, with the projects that have been going on, the museum and that, the cost overruns on those is quite a bit. It's cost about $3.5 million for the museum, and it's still not, completed yet.
So you're saying that this move around constitution celebrations and not raising the New Zealand flag, that's about kind of a tit for tat with New Zealand, or that's about trying to get a response?
I think it is, and I just hope Winston Peters, doesn't fall into a trap of, you know, giving things that really has got to be accountable for, you know, funding and that, and don't relax those protocols that they've got. But see, there's no New Zealand ministers coming up this time either. So, you know, there's something going on. And I hope that, public service and the SOEs become more accountable and transparent to the people on Niue as well as to the auditors.
You don't think it's a good idea to try and pursue a more independent outlook?
Oh, I don't think so, because, you know, the people will not support independence if they're going to lose the New Zealand passport. That passport has got a really strong feeling for the people, and they don't want to lose that.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program or have any suggestions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.